thanks for the
thank you also responsible for the invitation, and let me all say that as many visitors, I'm quite impressed by the aims of these institutes and also the by the capabilities to achieve that. Now, I would like to talk on local quantum physics compared opposed to quantum mechanics. This is a material which most of you are probably not familiar with, and for this reason I refer to the to this paper. I have during the last 3 days modified the paper a little bit, so to in order to agree to be closer to the content of this talk. But I don't know where this is a PDF file, and I don't know where I can place this stuff. Well, I will find out or ask people. So,
you don't know where you can place the file?
The file, yes.
I believe you can submit it directly to the archive, even PDFs.
No, no, I mean, this file is on the archive.
Oh, it is.
But I adjusted it particular for the purpose of this talk. So I wanted to place it locally if it's possible. But you know, it's
right. I see.
Okay, so let me highlight the aims. The aim of my talk, first I would like to highlight those structures of quantum field theory which are relevant in work on foundations of quantum theory. And in particular, I would like to talk about terminal against information theoretical entanglement and mention many facts which defy present work on quantum theory, foundational work on quantum theory. There's one exception, however. This is a work of Bob Clifton and his group at Pittsburgh. I think Halvorsen was involved in some of his papers. He really penetrated some of these problems, but unfortunately he died a couple of years ago, so I didn't see any recent continuation of this work. You may have wondered what this LQP, this stands for local quantum physics, and it is the same as quantum field theory, except that I use this LQP when I talk about quantum field theory a little bit beyond the textbook sort of quantum field theory. Now, the second point is, I don't want to just talk about matters of interpretation. If you have good concepts, they also should lead to new results. And so the second point is to mention some successes of this LQP, approach in particle physics. A universal area law for localization entropy, and the rigorous construction of certain strictly renormalizable models. From a philosophical point of view, this is turns out to be a special case of describing quantum field theory in terms of positioning of monads. So this is very interesting because it's a discrete structure and continuum at the same time, you will see. So the outline of my talk is as follows. First, I would like to talk about fundamental differences in entanglement, information theoretic versus thermal. The second point is this difference results from two completely different types of localization concepts. One is a Born, when it's adjusted to the relativistic realm, it's also called Newton-Wigner localization versus modular localization. Then there will be some remarks on relativistic quantum mechanics, or this is also known under the name of direct particle interactions. And I mentioned this in order to point out that this is still quantum mechanics, despite relativity. So it's not relativity alone, representation theory of the Poincaré group, which makes this big difference. The next point is modular localization. That's, so to say, causal localization, which is inherent in field theory, but liberated from particular fields. So, so to say, the intrinsic localization liberated from particular field coordinatizations. And I will mention the spatial version and the algebraic version. The next point will be a derivation of universal area law for localization entropy. And the method will be a combination of light front holography, if I explain that, combined with inverse Unruh effect. By inverse Unruh effect, I mean finding a heat bath system which is isomorphic to an Unruh system. I mean, a localized, in most cases, localization with respect to wedge. And this, as you know, this localization creates thermal aspects. Next point would be the setting of quantum field theory. This is my last point. Of quantum field theory in terms of positioning of a finite number of monads in a Hilbert space. And this is really quite exciting and challenging from a philosophical point of view. Okay, so then there will be some conclusions. Now, entanglement in quantum mechanics.
In your very first slide, you said something about rigorously renormalizable theory or something.
It means not super renormalizable. I mean, not the old William Jaffe theories, which were treated in the 60s. So, phi to the four coupling in two dimension. That's not what I mean. I mean, the ones which were treated were theories where the canonical commutation relations are valid. Short distance behavior is such that they are valid. And this is my mind.
Is this in four dimensions?
No.
This is also in two dimensions.
It's also two dimensions. These are integrable, so called integrable models in two dimensions. The quantum mechanics entanglement is as follows. You start from the position operator. As you start from the position operator, x op, and you make a spectral decomposition and obtain a family of Born projectors. So then you define the H of O in the Hilbert space by projecting the full original Hilbert space down with these projectors. And then, of course, your original Hilbert space tensor factorizes into H of O, and then the other factor is, of course, the Hilbert space which belongs to the complement of O. O is three dimensional here in this slide. Then the B of H is the tensor product, and of course, the commutant is. That's a commutant, that's a notation for commutant, is equal to the B of O complement. I use the notation B of O, which is an abbreviation for the space of all the algebra of all bounded operators B on this Hilbert space H of O. So then B of O itself. If you want to consider it as a subalgebra, then you must fill in this factor because B of O was defined as a factor space of H. Okay, this is a Born localized subalgebra, and I think I got this twice here. This is its commutant is Born localized in the complement. Now let's go to
some trivial point that I'm confused. That second equation makes it look as if H of O was a subspace of H.
Yeah.
but it's not really.
Oh, it's a factor space, right?
Yeah, so if you
it's a factor get space. It back,
second equation, it looks like you're getting it by applying a projection operator. So and the top one, go up to the right.
Yeah.
To the right now.
Okay.
This equation.
Yes. No, you project it down to it's a subspace, isn't it? If I apply a projector to the full space, I
it
get
would
a subspace.
Be, but on the left hand side, like what you're saying, it doesn't look like a
subspace. No, wait a moment. Oh, I'm sorry. This is very important. I use Fock space notation here, and that's not usual quantum mechanics notation. I want to have a multiplicativity. If I just would use Schrödinger's formulation, of course, this would not be true.
So if you are in the Fock subspace of like a one particle,
yeah,
that is a subspace. But then if you extend it to in the entire Fock space, it becomes a subsystem.
Yeah, but
this is right.
Right. Okay, so let's go on and talk about entanglement. We have three situations. You have entangled factorizing states like this psi. You have entangled pure states like this psi. And you have the density matrix states where rho designates the density matrix. And I think this is a much discussed subject here. The quantum mechanical entanglement is, in some sense, given a information theoretical formulation, and there are some people who even claim that we can get quantum mechanics from information theory.
One last thing, just on this little point. So on the first equation, do you want a direct sum there? H is H O plus?
I would if I talk about Schrödinger's situation, but I'm talking about the Fock space notation. And I have infinitely many particles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it looks like the two equations are notationally inconsistent. Maybe it's
okay,
not a big point.
Let's discuss it. I hope it's only a matter of notation.
Yeah.
Now, entanglement in quantum field theory, the carriers of causal localization are the quantum fields. They generate algebras. Your quantum field theory, your algebra in your global algebra, which belongs to full Minkowski space, is again B of H, like in quantum mechanics, there's no difference. But now you look at the local algebras, A of O, where O is compact or maybe even non-compact region, like a wedge. And then you realize to your astonishment that B of H is not the tensor product of A of O, times its commutant. Even though A of the commutant is, as before, the A of the causal complement in this case, you can establish. And even though the B of H is generated by these two von Neumann algebras, but they do not lie in a tensor product position.
So now O are
four-dimensional. They can be three-dimensional also, but you, when you talk about the region O, you always mean its causal completion. So if it's a three-dimensional region, it is in fact four-dimensional, a diamond or something like that. Now, there's a let me take a switch of terminology, which makes following discussions easier. Let me use a little bit more general concept of state. The state as a positive linear function on omega on an
Yeah, Yeah,
there we go.
Yes, the state has a positive linear functional omega on an operator algebra A. In this setting, the only intrinsic differences which remain are between pure and impure states. But there is no coupling of pure states with vectors anymore. This relation of states to vectors is, you can still introduce vectors via the so-called GNS construction, but there's but the notion of pureness and impurity is intrinsic. It doesn't refer to any representation in the Hilbert space. You just have states omega expectation positive expectation values on an algebra, and so the fact which is related to this funny behavior is that states on A of O are neither pure nor density operators. That's a very strange situation. They are, a typical state which represents pretty much the general situation are KMS states. So KMS states are limits of Gibbs states. Gibbs states themselves are, of course, density matrices. But if you take the thermodynamic limit and look at that open system, that theory you get, then it also has a Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian has a two-sided spectrum. And it is continuous, whereas the box Hamiltonian was discrete. Such KMS states as limits of Gibbs states. And the idea of defining those objects of statistical mechanics for which you need, a usual situation, V of H, quantum mechanical situation, the idea is if you have an inclusion, maybe I can draw it here. For example, the region O, which is causally complete, may be typically look like this double cone here. And you make it a little bit bigger, like this. So you have two algebras, one sitting two regions and also two algebras, one sitting in the other. And then the theory gives you a canonical quantum mechanical factor in the middle between the two, which has a fuzzy position. It is definitely contained in O epsilon, but it is larger than O, so it sits in here in some with some fuzzy boundary. This is a picture of for such algebras. This is called the splitting process. This inclusion here is called the split inclusion. So by this you then get this normal situation, the vacuum then restricted to this canonical algebra is like a density state, and you can compute its whatever you want, its energy density, entropy, and so on. And if you do this, you find that the entropy depends on this, it diverges, it depends on this distance epsilon, this epsilon. There's a whole sequence of of such canonical factors, which approach from the outside the all in a manner which is very similar to the thermodynamic limit. Yeah? The limiting situation is has this funny properties. These algebras I don't want to dwell on this, but they are of the hyperfinite type three factors. But they can be approached with ordinary factors. By the way, the algebra you get in the thermodynamic equilibrium in this limit is also type three. One factor is the same. There's no distinction to this local algebra. So this is the idea, and then you find that we will look at this in more detail, that the entropy is proportional to the transverse area of the horizon of O. The horizon of O would be I do the calculations later on for the wedge. The wedge region, so the horizon would be this would be the upper horizon. It's a light-like surface, and there is a entropy density which depends on this distance epsilon, which, by the way, diverges logarithmically, as we will see in a moment.
But the area also should be zero if it's a light-like surface.
I would calculate the area of an horizon, and it's usually zero, right?
With area, I mean, you see, there's an edge of this wedge.
Yeah, so it's
two dimensional. Space. The round dimensional, that's what I mean by area.
It's space like slicing of some horizon.
It's space like.
But then it depends on time.
Yeah. This would be the maximum area, right? The largest area. I mean, if you go up near the tip, then the area is.
I mean, for example, of course, in this case, the area is infinite. Yeah? It's an infinite factor.
It's zero.
The
wedge is like this. Okay.
It goes out on the blackboard. You will see some drawings. You will see some drawings later on.
But it's if you have a compact spatial region, and you think it's domain independent,
yes.
Then there'd be a kind of horizon. But the area would depend on where you sliced it. If you sliced it near the top, the area would be
zero.
If I have a wedge W, then the horizon of W is a unique object. I mean, there's no ambiguity in it.
If it's a wedge, yes. But suppose you started with this, couldn't you start with a
double
compact,
point, for example?
Yeah, for example.
Yes, that's a bit more complicated. So let's stay with wedges. I did all my computations with wedges, and we can then, of course, discuss to what degree it is independent.
So I understand what's the area of a wedge.
Not the area of a wedge. I mean,
the horizon. Okay.
The transverse. It's a transverse area. It's suppose it's a three-dimensional wedge. Then the edge is a line, and then if I have if I take a piece, a longitudinal piece of the wedge, then it's a strip, an infinite strip.
But then it's infinite. Okay.
The volume is also infinite. I mean, in the equilibrium, of course.
I want to ask a general question. It's probably not the place to talk. And you're talking about a relativistic quantum field.
I come to this relativistic quantum mechanics. This would be the right place, maybe.
Quantum mechanics.
Yeah, but okay. But
quantum field thing.
Yes.
So my question is a very naive question. Quantum mechanics, usually associated with entanglement, non-locality. depending on whose interpretation you take. And quantum relativistic quantum field theories, the standard relativistic quantum field theory, you have strict causality.
No, but this non-locality, which goes with the name of Bell, is fully in both the quantum theory. There's nothing you can do about it. But that's something which, states are always non-local states. In some sense, it's the algebras which are local in the sense of commutation relation, but this is, there's no contradiction to what you say. Okay, let me go on. So these local algebras are radically different from algebras in quantum mechanics. They are copies, they are all the same, independent of all. Independent of your matter, type of quantum matter you started with. If you have seen one, you have seen them all. Yeah? They have no inner structure by themselves. Life begins when you have, if you position them relative to each other. But for themselves, they are sort of void of any meaning. So they are, in some sense, monads, but they do have some preempted terminal aspect, namely the vacuum state, and by the way, all other finite energy states, all the finite particle states restricted to such local algebra become terminal. KMS, but they're not, of course, not terminal with respect, you're not creating any heat with respect to your original Hamiltonian of translations. They are getting their terminal with respect to a modular Hamiltonian, K, which depends on O, and which makes a movement only in this region O, and which is canonically determined by this data. I mean, you don't have to invent it from the outside. It's a part of modular theory.
But so is it determined by the state as well?
By the state as well, yes, we'll come to this here.
But no. When you say that they're all the same, so you're saying even a wedge, which is infinite,
yes,
or something like this causal diagram, yeah, they're all the same, except for the whole space, which is...
Except for the whole space. There's one mistake people usually make when make such a drawing. This does, of course, not mean that I know the local substructure of this wedge. That is much more. I mean, I don't know how these algebras, there are little double points in here. I don't know how they are situated. I only have one algebra. That's it.
But you're saying, I take any subset, say, any kind of a Cauchy surface,
yes,
and the corresponding domain, four dimensional.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's only two possibilities. Either it's the whole Cauchy surface, and then I get just the plain type 1 algebra, or it's a subset, and I always get this type 3 hyperfinite algebra.
Yeah. Those things are strictly true in Minkowski space, I'm saying here. But so there has to be a little bit careful, the localization cost entanglement, and in quantum field theory is not information theoretical, but rather terminal. As I said, it's not describable by a density operator. You will see this explicitly in a moment. The KMS property of which defines state W the following. You interchange the two operators which are in this, also have to be in this algebra A, and you make up for this by e to the minus k, where k is this modular Hamiltonian. The spectrum of k is continuous. So you cannot relate with e to the minus k a density matrix like here. and as I already said, all finite energy states of particle physics behave similar to the vacuum in this respect. Now, let me see, I think this is an example here. Yes. I have an example here. You take O equal to the wedge, yeah? This semi infinite region, and the vacuum state, and then the modular Hamiltonian is equal to the Lorentz boost, which is associated with that wedge. That's, of course, Ulmus observation, except that it's coming here from modular theory. And in general, in this case, of course, the K acts as a diffeomorphism, it's a Lorentz transformation. But in general, the K acts in a fuzzy way. It's not as a diffeomorphism at all. But it does leave the algebra invariant as a whole. Yeah? This the thermodynamic equilibrium states are limits of Gibbs density matrices. This one can show, and we will later use this see that this parallelism between localization chirality and heat bath, that's a normal chirality, is much more than an analogy. And with the help of light front orography, it becomes an isomorphism. So let's put in, this is just a remark that those algebras I'm using here, the monads, the R word, the finite type 3-1 factor, and the con used them to do this mathematical work for which he got the Fields Medal. So they play an important role. And by the way, this is very interesting. The whole terminology of KMS has been taken over by the mathematicians. KMS stands for Kuku Martin Schwinger. And in my notes, I have a lot of to say about this historical things, but I will not do this here. Then some remarks about this Born localization again.
By the way, speaking about history, I mean, there was an independent discovery of the Lunula effect by,
I have not invented this. I mean, I'm.
No, but you said that you showed a certain way of thinking about it, and you said it's not the way that Bill had thought about it.
No, the way of thinking I wanted to show is the analogy of heat bath terminality and localization terminality. That is my main point here.
I'm just saying it might have actually been the way it arose originally
in this
parallel work.
Okay, well, in my notes, maybe we find a place to listen. I do mention these interesting things. Now, there's a little bit of history if you read this. It's only the first step, you see. Mizenano and Michmann would be the step afterwards. Then, in the middle of the 60s, the work of Tomita and Takizaki, these mathematicians, merged together with the work of Haag, Hubenholz, and Windig. Those people, this is different from Mizenano and Michmann. They looked on open systems, on statistical mechanics on open systems. And they found that this computational trick of Kubo, Martin, and Schwinger has a very fundamental significance. And that's how this KMS notation entered here. Now, I should say something about the existence of relativistic quantum mechanics. That is something which is virtually not known by particle physicists, but I don't want to show it in order to convince you should use it, but it makes a nice, I think somehow it belongs to one's formation and one education to note that it's possible to have a quantum mechanics which is completely consistent and relativistic. I think Stefano, which we have mentioned something like that here some time ago. Okay, so we start with two particles. This is you add the interaction to the free mass operator. This is a free mass operator of two particles with the same mass. And then you form the Hamiltonian, and you have the boost generator. It's the same formula as usual, you just replace H0 by H. So then you show that the S matrix, or already the Miller operators, are really a Lorentz invariant. And the idea is very simple. You see, H is a positive function of M. So is H0 of M0. So you have the same positive function here and here. And then the theorem says in the limit of t going to infinity, it doesn't matter whether you have a positive function or whether you take the Hamiltonian or the mass operator, it doesn't matter. You get the same thing. So the S matrix comes out invariant with this two particle S matrix. And then you can, of course, the difficult step is for higher particles. It's very difficult because you cannot just add interactions. It would be violating relativity. So,
are you saying the two particle gets the S matrix is trivial? Is that what you mean?
No, no.
Or you're just saying it's not trivial.
But it's not trivial, no, no.
It's
finitely invariant. I mean, you mean because there are no tensors and vectors in this game here. They're just representations of the Poincaré group, and you. So if something is invariant, you have to show that something is independent of the frame you're in. So for three particles, it becomes more complicated. You write the M in this way. You can always add the three particle connected three particle interaction, like in one relativistic case also. So the V12 is the mass operator of a cluster, 1-2 cluster versus 3. You go into the center of mass system of this cluster, 1-2, and relative to 3, and so on. And there you define your mass operator in the usual way, using the old mass operator from your previous step, and so on. This can be continued to n particles, and but one actually needs this notion of scattering equivalence if you go to more than three particles. But at the end, this is what I want to emphasize: you have an S matrix which fulfills all requirements you can possibly think of in terms of particles. There are certain things which are brought in by fields into particle physics, by crossing symmetry and so on. This we don't get here for the S matrix, but cluster properties and so on. And so you get An example which contradicts Weinberg's conjecture, which was a relativistic estimate express cluster factorization should give one field theory. That's just not the case. This scheme goes with the name of Kresta and Polizu. And I just want to point out that it exists. And it's important to know, because the whole theory of Dirac was inconsistent. I mean, you can do certain calculations with the whole theory. This was, of course, done in the old textbooks, like Heitler and Menzel. But you cannot do the normalization theory, because it's not consistent. You will never see the normalization theory done in the particle whole picture. And so you could get the impression that if even the whole theory is inconsistent, that there might be no particle approach at all. That's not true. This is a purely particle based approach.
So are you saying there was no need to introduce quantum field theory? Really?
No. I'm not saying. I just want to
try to understand the claim. You're not attacking quantum field theory.
No, my only point is that there is a distinction between quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. Includes relativistic quantum mechanics on the side. Relativistic quantum mechanics is not on the side of quantum field theory.
But usually people say you have to take the step of second quantum.
I know.
Because a fixed number.
I'm not making propaganda for this. You misunderstand me completely.
No, you misunderstand me. Okay. I'm just trying to understand what you're telling us. It's quite interesting, so I'm trying to bring
that. Okay, let's leave it like this. You could have thought, that quantum field theory is relativistic quantum mechanics. Many people see this all the time. I see it, I read this. This is not true.
Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
This is his claim.
Okay, that's the thing.
Okay, so let me now come to
the claiming that relativistic quantum mechanics was the same as quantum field.
Was it?
Who claims this?
Nobody claims this, but this work of Polizu and Kresta was published in nuclear. I mean, they're theoretical nuclear physicists. It's a marvelous work, and they use it for phenomenology. For intermediate energies, where you have already, this can be generalized to a finite number of creation, of meson creation. You can couple such channels. The way I've written it here, it was purely elastic scattering. But this, and they use it to do computations for where only, say, a couple of pions in the nucleon-nucleon collisions are produced. And they say that this is already relativistic, but you don't know how to solve such problems from the point of view of quantum field theory. And so they want to do things by following at least some principles which they can implement, instead of fitting only. You can look at these papers. I think they succeeded. But for me, it only has this purpose of it's a subject which should belong to an intellectual knowledge of a particle physicist, that there exists something like that. I mean, I would never use it. It was field theory, because it's much more fundamental. It's phenomenological. But it's maybe not. And this is, by the way, what Stippenberg should have found when he was criticizing Heisenberg's S-matrix theory. And he he was pointing out a property called macro causality, that you have processes of causal list that one particle comes out and then the next particle scatters on that particle. And this, but of course you only have, you have Feynman propagators, but you have Feynman propagators only for asymptotic distances, not for finite region. And so used the Feynman propagators throughout and made point where this is and had Feynman noise before Feynman. So, but he should have done this here. So let me continue with spatial modular localization. We start with the Wigner space of one particle space. For simplicity, I take spin zero. So this is the characterization of the Wigner space. And we only need, from all the Poincaré transformations, two transformations. One is the Lorentz transformation. That we need the Lorentz transformation, and now coming back to this drawing here, we have a wedge here. X1 is bigger than the time component absolute, and X2 and X3 are arbitrary. Yes? So so we will take as our lambda, the lambda W, which belongs to this W, this one parametric subgroup. And there will also be a reflection operator, JW, which reflects along the edge of the wedge. So, and both operators, that's easy to see, both operators commute. They are chosen in such a way that they commute with each other. And then you have rather interesting consequences. So we have now these two operators, U of lambda W0, depending on the Lorentz boost parameter, and this reflection. And let's see what we can get from this. We define an unbounded closed antilinear involute operator, and that's fracture S, by J times delta to the 1/2. Now, the unitary operator from the Wigner theory was this delta to the IT. And so you change, instead of the hyperbolic angle, you use this parameterization here. And then you, so to say, analytically continue in the T to get to this plus 1/2 here. And these operators have well-defined, they coming from Wolf theory, so the analytic continuation have well-defined domain properties. And now the this S is has a property of S squared is equal to 1 on its domain. That's written. S itself is an unbounded operator. This is very interesting, because you in the whole literature of mathematics and physics, you don't find such operators which are with this property, which are unbounded and yet S squared, yes, they are involutive. Simon Reed or so, it's not in there. They are very typical for a modular theory. And so the more detailed characterization of the domain of these operators can be given in terms of real subspaces. This, you see, this S squared is equal to 1 in a sense, and so you have plus 1 eigenvalue and minus 1 eigenvalue. So define a real subspace. This is real because S is antilinear. So you cannot multiply this by I without changing the sign here of the space. So, and when you have defined the space K, you can also define the space IK just by just items times the space K, you know, which is space K, and then you know what this, how this S of W acts on this I phi. Now, this one can do for the wedge. I've written the things for the wedge. And then you can convince yourself that these K spaces are what mathematicians call standard. I mean, their closure, the closure of the of K plus IK is a full Hilbert space. And the intersection of K with IK is zero. And so talking about operators S and this above, or about spaces K, is completely synonymous. And having the K spaces, you can then by intersections, by forming intersections, get to spaces which have a smaller localization, for example, double bonds. You must then take the intersection over all so that O is contained in all of the W's which you intersect, and so on. So you.
Can you remind us what was the delta exactly? How was it physically? What was the meaning of
The meaning of this delta ET is the Wooster transformation, just parameterized in a slightly different way. This is Wooster growth to, belonging to W.
Now, the first
you
have delta to the one hand.
No, okay.
The one before.
Yes, so this is an analytic continuation. You put T equal to minus I times T equal to minus I times 1/2.
So the delta, before you analytically continue,
this is a bounded operator, okay? That's unitary. Okay. And when you analytically continue, you have domain.
I'm not asking such a deep question, advanced question. I'm just asking
notation.
That delta sub W naught was a boost operator, is that right? The one that was on the previous, no, to the left.
So this here.
This one here. That delta.
Well, it's the value of this, but T equal to, how do you get 1/2?
Oh, I see.
T equal to minus 1/2. Yeah?
So the one on the right is the boost operator.
Yes, that's the boost operator. Okay, so you get, so this is the idea of spatial localization. You localize within one particle linear space, you can. Produces localization, and it's quite a deep theory for me.
So what's the JW not doing again? In front of the
this is a reflection, that's anti-linear.
Okay, so that's
a unitary operator.
That's like a complex structure.
That's like a TCP operation. I mean, it's it's a reflection.
It reverses time.
It reverses time, and this first coordinate, x1, which remember, the wedge W0 was a T, TX1 wedge, yeah? So it reverses those both, the least and the best.
So it takes this wedge into the opposite.
It's a reflection on the edge of the wedge. It's on the opposite, right? Correct. Takes it in the opposite. So then then you can go directly after having understood the spatial part. You can, at least for free fields, doing the algebraic part is turns out to be very easy. So what you do, you define while operators, these are called unitary operators, as exponential I, A of psi, A dagger of psi, where psi is from the, you use now the k of the belonging to the wedge W. You take a wave function, a linear wave function, which has this properties which I explained before belonging to KW. And then you, and this, these are just linear creation and annihilation operators. There's nowhere an A of X here, smear A of X. That's not, so these are. These are objects you get from the Wigner theory without knowing a priori what localization is, but having gone through this modular discussion. Then the, you define A of W as the algebra generated by all these modular operators with psi of from A of A. And so the let's see what is not so important. So let's now look at this in the picture here. That is kind of sort of interesting. So you have this set of real Hilbert spaces inside the Wigner space K of W, and each one is mapped using this Weyl functor. It's a functor now. It maps wave functions into algebras, into A of W. Then by intersecting this, you get you come to K of O, as I explained before, and you can also do the intersection on this side. And the process commutes. I mean, if you first do this and then go to the via the functor to the algebra, or you take this part, it doesn't matter. So there's in free field theory at least there's a very close relation between there's a functorial relation between spaces and algebras. This is a mathematical interlude. If you want, I can stop. But I can continue, and somehow I got.
You turned towards that, and so. It's a little
bit okay, so let me say that. That this is a mathematical interlude. On
yeah, modular, so it started with it, right?
Yeah,
on modular theory, the amazing thing about modular theory is this. Is this Tomita-Takasaki theorem? You define an operator S, which I call S Tomita. I should have put the index Tomita here. So. You define it this way. You take, you run through all operators of your algebra A and set this operator and its image required to be equal to A star. So A star is the Hermitian adjoint of this operator. So very natural definition. Then, if the algebra, if this prerequisite is met, that the algebra is a standard position, which means, with respect to omega, which means that it acts on omega cyclic, it means that it generates a dense set of states acting on the dense set of states in the Hilbert space, and it is also separating. It means it doesn't contain any annihilate in this algebra, anything which annihilates the vacuum. Under these circumstances, you have this marvelous theory. The polar decomposition of S will lead to two operators, J and this, the delta IP. The delta IP, and this is a non-trivial part of the theorem, the delta IP acts like an automorphism on the algebra. I mean, this is, of course, not meant point-wise here. It reshuffles, but within this algebra, A is assigned for the algebra. And J throws the algebra into its commutant. So this is quite powerful, isn't it? Because it's obviously related to locality and causality and this property. There's a very important modification coming from the interaction. Maybe I can skip this. I mean, it's certainly in the notes if you want to look at it. So let's look at it in the next slide. The light font holography and the entropy. Entropic area law, this is some of all. The light font holography is described on the next page in more detail by some drawings. And let me just say what it does. It leads to a very radical space time reordering. Of the bulk algebra, and it is okay. So we don't have to look at all the details. The surprising structural property is that this is the most important thing. That this totally rigorous, as rigorous as TCP and spin and statistics and so on. The transverse part. Of the light form theory. We'll see a little bit about how this is done on the next page. But the transverse part is quantum mechanical. It has no, the vacuum has no, it factorizes. There's no entanglement whatsoever. So this is all the entanglement. In the light font projection goes to the into the longitudinal, into the light ray direction, and therefore it's not surprising that the commutation relations of light font fields they look like now they look like they look like this here. You have the transverse part, that's a delta function. The quantum mechanical delta function, which is always there, and you have this longitudinal part with derivatives. It's very important that the derivatives of these delta functions are odd, and so delta prime or delta 3 prime and so on. And this oddness is connected with vacuum polarization of the correlation functions in that direction. And this delta function expresses the absence of any vacuum fluctuations. This light font holography is not the same as the Toft's idea, because it isn't a genuine projection. You cannot, knowing the light font algebras, you do not have enough knowledge to go back to the bulk. You have to add some knowledge. Yeah? So this is, of course, what one expects naively. This idea of Toft, it's about quantum gravity. I don't know. I've never seen any argument or proof of this. Now, let's see. Yeah, here I explain some of the holographic procedure. I have the wedge, and I slide the this wedge into itself by distance a, and I take the relative I take the commutant, the relative commutant. I mean, I take the commutant of W of AWA within A of W. So that's, as we can see geometrically, this is what, sitting on this line, which is which is on a light ray. This is the direction of the light ray. So this is the way forming these intersections you get the algebras of you get the you resolve the locality in light wave direction, but only there. This interval still stands for a algebra which is infinitely expanded in a perpendicular direction, and so you have to, in order to resolve also the locality in perpendicular transverse direction, you use other transformations. You use a little group of Wigner, by which you you can see that the projection of the little group of the light ray allows you to tilt this this stretch here and take the intersection, and so you have a compact region D, and combining both you get a the local net on the light front. Okay, what is interesting here, let me not go into any detail, but the result of the calculation I should perhaps comment on. The localization entropy is turns out to be proportional to the transverse area times the logarithm of epsilon, where epsilon is this distance. It's a certain, it's an attenuation length physically, which you, for which, in which the vacuum polarization is allowed to settle down. So this is an attenuation length. It's not a cutoff here in this, I want to make sure that. Not like it, I mean, there are a lot of similarities to liking Jacobson's point of view, but this is different. This is not a momentum space cutoff, but an attenuation length in the theory. I'm not changing the theory. So, what is really remarkable is what you can prove by this inverse Unruh effect is this product here. A times L and epsilon is precisely the volume factor which you get in heat bath, in the heat bath treatment. If you would look at the global system on the light front, then you, you find, of course, the volume factor times the density. And it corresponds exactly to this. So this takes away a little bit from the mystique of this area law. The area law is nothing else. It's completely equivalent. It's isomorphic, if you do the right connection, with the heat bath. It's only that the parametrization, you see, this light front theory brings in the chiral theory, a conformal theory, and conformally long distances and short distances are, can be transformed into each other. So, this L and epsilon is equal to a factor length L. And you find this in the notes. I don't want to. Let me at the end, perhaps, since it's sort of amusing, So this all belongs to this previous discussion. But let me at the end say something about the doing quantum field theory in terms of positioning of monads. This is, I think, something.
Can I ask something on the calculation? In an arbitrary interacting theory, in a free theory, or in what?
Well, you've seen there is a constant C in there, which is, of course, I don't know. I mean, if you take interacting matter in the bar, I do not, in this life form projection, I cannot tell you precisely what C value it corresponds to. It's this Virasoro constant, which, in typical cases, it's a Virasoro constant which comes out there. But in free theory, it's just the degree, it's the number of components of fields which comes in there. So it's not completely universal in the Wittgenstein sense. It does depend a little bit on the matter. So if you use it for black holes, it would maybe see a difference between the different matter content. But I don't know that this, I mean, I can only do these calculations for three cases. And that's the thing you exactly what you expect.
But the derivation of the area law is more general than just the free theory.
Oh, yes. No, it's completely general. It's just the, it has nothing to do with the freeness, except that for you can make things, certain things more explicit for the free theory. Is it an interesting, not a contradiction, but I think there are still some. Of course, it fits Wittgenstein, who starts from geometric theories and from Einstein-Hilbert-like theories, and then you find on the purely classical level. Quantities which have an area behavior. This of course fits, but it is completely independent, and has also a priori nothing to do with gravity, except that, of course, these horizons which we're talking about are purely mental objects. I mean, nobody knows how to localize in nature. Yeah? So this is the Diamond experiment of Unruh. But even that is a bit esoteric. I mean, you have an observer which is uniformly accelerated, but in the case of the role which black holes plays in this game is that it defines, I mean, objectively, there is a horizon there. It's not just a mental exercise like here. The speculation of this, but these mental exercises are, of course, useful because you learn something about the structure of the theory. There's nothing. You can tell an experimentalizer to do maybe, but it reveals a lot about the structure. But so let me just let me wrap up things. This last point is this monad picture, and of course you can discuss this if you're interested in this. With me privately. And it says that, for example, to make a two-dimensional quantum field theory, you need to position, to place three monads in a certain position, and the fantastic thing is that you get from this placement. It's purely algebraic. It has nothing to do with geometry. And you get not only the whole net of algebras, but you get the Poincaré group also from there. The Poincaré group is manufactured from this modular group. So for four-dimensional theories, you need seven monads placed into a certain position. I think this is very challenging this is something you definitely cannot never do in quantum mechanics. Impossible. But this is what you see. This gives a completely different insight into quantum field theory, much beyond the textbook quantum field theory. One gets the impression that one is only at the beginning of understanding quantum field theory. My talk may not have been very convincing, but I tell you, these things are absolutely rigorous. Okay, thank you very much.
Is there any question? So on this last thing you just said, like placing the monads to get the Poincaré group. So you place the monads, but you also have like some sort of automorphism in these algebras or something like that?
No, you use modular theory.
Okay, so
yeah. So you place them into modular position. For example, here this is a very important modular position, N and N. It's called modular inclusion. If the modular automorphism group of the bigger one compresses for one sign, T going say T positive, if it compresses inside the smaller one.
So
then that's exactly what you really want. Yeah, the positioning is following such rules. Yeah? But they are extremely
Okay, so the positioning itself makes use of the modular group, so that's what you mean.
Yeah, yes, but each algebra, of course, has a modular.
Yeah, sure. So that's what you mean by positioning. Okay.
But you demand something like that. Otherwise, you would get much more. You want to get to quantum field theory. And, yeah. So this is the way to do it.
Do these correspond to regions in two-dimensional matrix?
Yeah.
So which three regions?
I have the picture there. Let's see, maybe on the next slide. No. Maybe before. No, but I can say it in words. The W is a wedge, and then you take this here, this wedge, and this wedge.
So you haven't even filled up the whole infrastructure.
No. They're inside. Everything is inside the bigger wedge, and not the.
So you're producing the quantum field theory for the Hohmann Kochsky space?
Yeah.
But all from this.
Yeah. But what the trick is, of course, you get from this situation, you get this the Poincaré generators, and then you shuffle everything around. It's really amazing. It's something really to think about.
To get these modular automorphisms or whatever you want, you really need the vacuum state, or you need a state somewhere in the vacuum.
Yes.
So how do you know what that is without having
to start? No, in Minkowski space.
But suppose unless you knew that these were part of Minkowski space, would you know how to recognize
the theorem is an abstract theorem in the following sense. You have these three algebras, monads, in a modular position. I mean, there are two modular inclusions, as you can see. And then you assume that all three of them have the same, property of being cyclic. Cyclic and with respect to the same vector. That's important. It turns out to be the Markian vector at the end, because then this means that the modular transformations leave this vector invariant. That's an input. But you don't know that it's It's not on a group yet.
So you don't have states on the algebra, you just have the three algebras.
I have three algebras, concrete algebras in the Hilbert space. Let's assume that there is a vector, a joint vector, so that these properties for modular theory.
You're fixing the definition of the algebra from the beginning.
Yeah.
Saying a number space. It's a von Neumann algebra.
I don't have to do this because there's an abstract von Neumann algebra theory where you don't talk about the Hilbert spaces, but at the end it is precisely.
Yeah, you mentioned this about it.
I think so.
To understand, what is the input? The input is three algebras.
Three algebras.
And nothing more. Three concrete algebras.
Three concrete algebras. In a certain position, let's call it modular position, in a certain modular position. But this word modular position is purely algebraic. There's no geometric idea in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so geometric.
Then it necessarily produces quantum field theory and Minkowski space. So what would you do? What would you do if it was a curved space?
That's a good question. I have thought about this, and of course, the question. My first question was: can I understand the diffeomorphisms of the circle? See, in conformal theory, the only from this modular setup. I only get the Möbius transformations, not the diffeomorphism of the circle. That's an infinite group. And that doesn't answer your question, but it goes a little bit in this direction. So what the question is there positioning which gives me this rich infinite dimensional group? And I think I can do it, but it's very much in its infancy.
Another question. I don't believe that epsilon is not a cutoff. It must be physically a cutoff. Because all calculators go basically
the same way. But usually, what I understand in cutoff is when you do a normalization theory, and theory is non renormalizable, let's say, you say I don't want to take this theory serious all the way. This is my understanding of a cutoff. But then you are by introducing this cutoff, you lose all control. Nobody, I have never seen in all my life what is a theory with a cutoff. I mean, that is completely solved models, factorized models. Everything is known about them, but I wouldn't know how to introduce a cutoff. I just don't know. That's a nice way of talking about it.
Well, that's what, but I mean, it has the effect of a cutoff. What you did was thicken the. You did something, I'm not quite sure what it was.
You expanded
the region a little bit by epsilon.
But you didn't do anything to the.
So maybe I think, so another way of putting your question is like, when you use this in what you call the inverse unruh effect to derive the area law, then that fixes epsilon that you get in the log epsilon, the value of epsilon is fixed. So what is the mechanism that fixes that epsilon?
Oh,
in this inverse effect. So then you can understand it.
Okay.
There's
a theorem, the theorem says the following. More general, you have a chiral theory on the line, and you have a terminal state, a heat bath terminal state on it. The theorem says that is equivalent, isomorphic, to having an interval, or say the corresponding thing to the wedge would be a half interval, and the vacuum restricted to the half interval, which is the localization terminality. There's an exact isomorphism. I don't know how to prove this in Heimat.
The vacuum constrictors that they have, I mean, this is exactly the calculation you did many years ago. So you set out, say, a quantum, a free quantum field. I think we did a scalar field. You set up a scalar field theory in Kautsky space. Now you restrict it to the half, to this, you know, introduce a Cauchy surface. Restrict it to the half of the Cauchy surface, which would be the part inside your wedge. Now you compute, in the vacuum state, you get an effective density matrix for the half that you've got.
Well, it's not the density.
Well, it is. I mean, this is, you know, this is not at the same level of rigor, but
okay,
it's a physicist level of rigor. So you get an effective density matrix, and you can compute its entropy, and you get a formal expression, which involves an integral operator. I forget exactly all the details. And you can see that the answer, without any, if you don't put any cutoff, then the answer will be infinite. And the reason, the physical reason, hold on. The physical reason is simple. It's because you have an infinite number of modes near the boundary, and each one of them is entangled with a neighboring mode on the other side of the boundary. And if you let, if you keep all those modes, although when we actually did it, well, this wasn't something we published, there seems to be an extra sort of contribution that's not associated with any particular mode that also blows up. I always would have liked to understand better. But anyway, basically it's coming from the sum of all these modes.
Mm-hmm.
And that state, essentially, we're computing is precisely the one you're talking about. It's the thermal state, which is the vacuum restricted to the half space. Now you have to get a finite answer, you have to make the contributions from all of those very short wavelength modes drop out at some distance. That distance is what I'm calling the cutoff. It's not necessarily changing the theory. It's just not taking into effect the contribution from those very short wavelength modes.
But
you must be doing something equivalent.
Similar, but not the same. This heat path terminal system on the line from which I start has an entropy which is length in this case a volume factor times a specific times an entropy density, right? Let's we can actually show that.
So that should be for unit transfers.
Now, this transformation I'm talking about, which is rigorous, transforms this L into this epsilon. It's not, no, can't, I mean,
if you cannot invent, you're taking a finite light.
If you call this cut off.
That's an infrared difference.
That's right.
That's also
that's
there.
But this is a kind of theory in which this is done. This theory is on the light cone, a kind of. So they have this property. That I'm not claiming that in general that the heat bath theory has anything to do with the localization terminality. I'm not saying that. I'm saying specifically if you have a theory, a heat bath theory in a chiral heat bath theory on the line, this has a very precise definition. And you write it as a in the spirit of a sequence of Gibbs states. Then you get a factor L, volume factor, times the density, which is finite. We are not there.
But there's some transformation you did on the original theory. What do you mean by a chiral theory? The original theory is just saying.
No, the original. This is not a statement about the original theory.
Yeah,
maybe that's
what
your statement was.
Mine is
the
about the
original
theory.
No, this was not. No.
So the.
No, this is.
So that's the thing that epsilon got into the definition of the chiral theory somewhere, and the question is where does it get into the definition of the chiral theory?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. If we see how it got into the definition of the chiral theory. Then we'll understand whether it has the physical meaning
of a cutoff
or not.
Right. So my statement is with respect to light front physics, from the very beginning. I have no, of course, I think that leading terms, and actually there are calculations like that, that for the leading terms you get this logarithm, this log in epsilon. Because there the difficulty is that you do not have a, you must do the calculation directly without reference to the inverse envelope. So that, because that hinges on the on the chiral, that's only true for this chiral.
What do you mean by chiral?
I mean the conformal field theory on the line.
Okay.
That's, this is the simplest type of field theory in a way. That's what you get from this life form.
So a free scalar field, massive scalar field,
yeah,
is an example of what you mean by chiral field.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why he calls it chiral, but anyway.
That's standard terminology. The conformal field theory on the line. There's a Möbius covariant theory. That's what I get here.
So the line is a circle, or the line is an.
It can be compacted by that.
So we have to understand where the epsilon, because the kind of. The kind of answer you typically get in, back in your real space time is the cutoff has the meaning of a length, and the entropy goes as 1 over the line squared. Because, of course, it, for dimensional reasons, it has to. It's the area of the horizon. In, entropy is dimensionless, right? So the,
okay.
So the, you have to get the area of the horizon divided by some length squared,
mm-hmm.
and that length is the cutoff.
Yes, but this modular, you can do modular theory without this life form stuff, right? Like in this drawing, you have a double cone, slightly smaller double cone. Then the, there is a clear definition of an entropy in X space, which depends on certain distances.
Yeah, but you have that distance, that epsilon has to do with the distance between
the two corners. It's an X space, it's a calculation, I mean this theory.
So what's the relation about, what's, so if I set up two cones like this,
mm-hmm.
then there's a certain distance between the two, right? There's that two sphere that bounds the cone, I don't know what you call it.
Let me explain
this. There's a certain distance. What's the relation? Let me call that distance delta. What's the relation between that delta and your parameter epsilon?
I did not prove that, but I think that in the limit of delta going to zero at this term, I think.
Then what is this?
That's not the rigorous. I mean.
So you think delta equals epsilon?
Yeah.
But then, there's a dimensional.
But I can tell you one rigorous calculation. You take this is what I call chiral theory on the line, and you you make instead of making this epsilon here, I can separate. This interval here from the complement, and I do it.
Right.
I do it by, so I have four points: A, B, C, and D. Right. And this I can compute. Then the entropy.
But this is almost exactly what we did. And by separating them, what you do is you.
But,
get
okay. So it is. A function of the harmonic anharmonic ratio because it's conformal. So it's a function. This epsilon in this case would be a b minus a times d minus c divided by d minus a times c minus. I'm speaking. And in leading order, for if this is very, very small, so this is and the epsilon, so you and this is rigorous, yeah, this it's a function of this harmonic ratio.
But that's the entropy of the bath on which part? Oh. That's the entropy of some heat bath.
That's not that's the localization entropy of this interval. I have
but you there are no more transverse directions, is that right? You've left out the transverse directions.
No, I'm on.
You're just on the
line.
Yeah, so on the line, the entropy is, I mean, the area of the horizon is dimensionless on the line, so that's okay.
Okay.
So this is basically log of epsilon squared over.
Yeah. Right.
Over.
That's what it is.
Would you want 1 over that, I suppose? Minus that?
No.
Log of.
Wait a moment, maybe I should have written. Okay.
This is basically L, let's say big L squared over epsilon squared, where big L is the length.
Now, this computation does not rely on this inverse one over.
So, this is not an area law, right? That's because.
No, that's not an area law because there's no.
No, I think it's not an area law because
no.
It's not a law because it has this log of L in it, where L is the length of that line.
But it's the way in which in the
lifetime
computation the log of epsilon n, it's a way because it comes through in a light ray because there's no fluctuation transverse. So whatever you compute is always proportional to the area because there's no fluctuation in this direction. So you must compute, the only thing which remains is computation of this localization entropy in the light-like direction. And this is this picture.
But I saw, is this A minus B, is that the same as your epsilon? Or you think it's
it's the epsilon is the whole.
This is a conformal theory, right?
Yeah, yes.
So I don't even understand. A minus B could be anything.
This is a measure, the epsilon measures how far the opposite is from the original interval. So the limit you're taking here is the coalescence limit of this point scale.
Yeah, but what's the invariance group on this line exactly?
On the line, it's a Möbius group. On the light front, it is a.
Okay, so it's the Möbius group. So
it's the same parametric subgroup of the.
You can't make an argument. So I saw that something is wrong because the entropy has to be dimensionless. Right. Let's go back to the four-dimensional theory. So the entropy has, when you compute the entropy, if it's a physical entropy, in the four-dimensional theory, it has to come out dimensionless. So can you write down. The entropy is the expression. The expression that you're led to in the end, in the four dimensional.
I didn't pay much attention to dimensions. For example, when I said that L, this L factor in the heat bath, case, is the logarithm, absolute logarithm of epsilon, I didn't pay any attention at all to. To like it means that epsilon is something like e to the minus L, where L is the length.
So log of epsilon is L.
So you said
the log of epsilon is L. Yes.
You say like the log of epsilon.
The log of epsilon is L. Yes, but it's but the coordinates which are important for this description is not L of the heat bath system. But it's epsilon of the because you are talking about a sequence of algebras which goes towards an interval compact.
Yeah, but let's go back to that wedge in space time. Okay. So what is L? Is L the transverse length of the wedge? What is L?
L is the would be the length. I mean, the heat path system would be a system on this three-dimensional plane.
Okay.
And L would be the length in this direction.
L is the length in that too.
Yeah. And the area would be
but no, the area, the entropy doesn't depend on the length in that direction. In the end, that has to drop out physically.
It depends on the cutoff. That doesn't look bad. I mean, I'm agreeing with you. The entropy of the limiting case is infinite, but the entropy of...
So the limit is the L getting bigger and bigger?
But that's also infinite. It's both things
are infinite.
That's the heat path system is going to infinity. L is for the heat path the system. It goes to infinity in both directions. Yeah?
What about the transverse then? Where is that in? Is this supposed to be the entropy per unit area in the transverse direction? Or be at length, I guess.
Well, depending on when we have to agree, are you talking about the heat path system or about the...
I'm always talking about the physical system.
Well, both are physical, I mean.
Well, no. I mean, one of them is just a model, it's just a device for calculating.
Which one?
The heat path.
No, it's like, I think the point is like the restriction, and you have this equivalent between that restriction and the heat path.
But this heat path is on the horizon or something like that. Is it? It's another null space.
Okay, I see your point. You can say that the heat path is a computational trick. Yeah?
That's what I'm saying.
And the real system I'm interested in is localization on the half line, for example.
For example.
Yes, and then the statement is that we both agree on this. The limiting case, I mean, you're approximating. An entropy which you cannot define because it's infinite by a sequence. But you're doing the same thing in heat path cases. It's only that that you have a cut on instead of a cut off.
Because
of the volume factor. It's nothing different here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the relationship of that number. So I think.
Great.